Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Sam Tannenhaus. This week, a first, we think, in our fabled history, our how-to special issue. It includes conversations with the Times' political correspondent, Nicholas Confessori, who tells us how to win a political election.
The formula seems very, very simple. So simple that at first I was kind of frustrated at reviewing this book because I thought, is that all there is?
Humorist Henry Alford explores what it takes to be a man in modern America.
This is a dude who had an easy bake oven as a kid. He once designed a recipe for wine coolers.
And Greg Coles, who's the mastermind of this particular issue, has bestseller news. Campaign season is upon us, and there are two presumptive nominees who are trying to figure out how to win. There's a new book. It's called The Candidate, What It Takes to Win and Hold the White House. It's by Samuel L. Popkin, and it's reviewed for us by one of the Times' great political correspondents who's been covering the campaign, Nicholas Confessori, who's here to talk about it. Welcome, Nick.
Hey, Sam.
All right, first tell us who Popkin is and what case he has to make in this book.
Sam Popkin is a professor of political science at the University of California. He has two specialties, campaigns and Southeast Asian politics, but the campaign specialty is where we are at right now. He has been a sometime advisor to a few campaigns, going back, I think, to the Carter campaign, where I believe he even stood in as a debate stand-in for Ronald Reagan. So he's been on the—
You mean for one of the practice sessions?
Exactly, for a practice session. Yeah. So he's been both a political scientist specializing in how voters process information, how they make decisions about candidates. And he's occasionally been a consultant on polling and strategy and the way that public policy people and intellectuals often are.
Okay, so he knows a lot. He's very experienced. He's a trained political scientist. Does he really know what it takes to win and hold the White House? Is there a formula, or does he have several different scenarios he presents?
Well, what's intriguing about the book is that the answer, the formula, seems very, very simple. So simple that at first I was kind of frustrated at reviewing this book because I thought, is that all there is? Essentially, the secret is to have a well-organized campaign staff, to have certain people playing certain roles, to have a chief of staff who is an honest broker who doesn't use his access to the candidate to control the direction of the campaign. You want to have a person who is in charge of keeping the family in the loop so that the family doesn't bombard the candidate with miscellaneous advice and kind of pull the candidate off the strategy.
You mean the candidate's actual family, spouse,
yes,
kids?
Spouses, cousins, old friends who are always weighing in. So the advice is kind of all at the end of the book. The way he gets there is to talk about the three different kinds of campaigns that almost everybody runs. There is the challenger who is running against the incumbent. There is the incumbent who is running for re-election. And there is the successor, who is usually a vice president who is trying to succeed their old boss.
Al Gore, George H.W. Bush, Walter Mondale. So does he provide historical examples or actual campaigns and take you inside, sort of show how they work?
He provides lots and lots of historical examples. I would say one problem with the book is too many examples. There is lots and lots of great political trivia in there. I'm a political junkie. I like it. I like reading it. One challenge with the book is you have to get through a lot of stuff, and sometimes the thesis, the points, are a little bit obscured by all the trivia. But he does take you through three central campaigns. The challenger campaign he focuses on is Hillary Clinton in 2008. The successor he focuses on is Al Gore in 2000. And the incumbent is George Bush in 1992. Mm. So he takes you deep into these campaigns. He sort of narrates the campaign with a lot of detail, a lot of context, and then tries to step back and say what did and did not work. And in each of these campaigns—
They were all failures.
They were all failures. First of all, they all lost, and that's the key takeaway. With Hillary Clinton, you found that there was a campaign staff that was regimented and siloed, as they say, where Mark Penn was both top strategist and top pollster. No one liked him. He didn't want to cede any turf. He had a vision for the way the campaign would go. He refused to adapt. But because of the position he held and the power he held in the campaign, there was no one who could make him change the strategy, and Hillary Clinton trusted him. So that was the staff problem there. With George H.W. Bush, You had a chief of staff, an arrogant chief of staff.
It was 1992 when he ran against Bill Clinton.
That's right. He has John Sununu as a chief of staff in the White House. The whole White House is having a problem coordinating with the campaign staff. They're very afraid of breaking campaign rules about coordination between government and campaigns and politics. So there's not a lot of communication. The personalities don't trust each other. Sununu thinks he's a deputy president, so he's always closing off access to the president. And when they realize it's not the Cold War anymore, that this is a new Democrat who's going to avoid their attacks on welfare and affirmative action by being more centrist, they can't respond. They are too insular and too ridden with factional disputes to respond. And then you get finally to the Al Gore campaign. Here is more of an example of this is a guy who couldn't figure out exactly why I was running. There was no good message. But he also had a problem of he was very resentful of Bill Clinton. He thought a lot of his problems were Bill Clinton's fault. He had a hangover from the scandal. His family and friends agreed with him and would play to that. And Al Gore would empower advisors and even bring in new advisors like the feminist thinker.
Oh, Naomi Wolf.
Naomi Wolf, that's right, to tell him to be more of an alpha male or wear earth tones, right? And he would disregard his own campaign strategy. And so they also sort of couldn't stay on the ball.
Okay, Nick, this suggests at least that, all right, you may have an organizational problem or a communication problem, but much of it begins with the candidate, him or herself, right? Because they make the decisions. They decide whom to trust and whom not to trust. Mm-hmm. And it almost seems as if some of these breakdowns or failures are reflections of attributes we saw in those candidates themselves, no?
Yeah, to some extent, that's certainly true. You know, Hillary Clinton, she apparently did want to adapt the campaign a little bit. And of course, we saw some of that in New Hampshire in 2008, where she wanted to show a little more of her personal side, was less worried about appearing strong and resolute as a female candidate.
Which is what Mark Penn wanted her to do. He wanted her to be a kind of Margaret Thatcher almost.
Exactly,
right?
Exactly. But ultimately, it was Hillary Clinton who trusted her top aides, who trusted Mark Penn, gave him that power, failed to see how it would be problematic for her down the line. And ultimately, the candidate can't really manage their own campaign. That's a running problem in politics, is people who try to be their own campaign manager. So she delegated to a guy, or rather, she tried to have the guy she trusted most kind of run the campaign. And people were afraid to give her bad news. People were afraid to tell her things that she didn't want to hear. And ultimately, again, they could not respond to a changing environment, which was Barack Obama.
Now, Nick, does Sam Popkin also look at a really successful campaign like Bill Clinton's in 92 or Barack Obama's in 2008 as kind of a form of contrast and say, here's how you do it, or here's what they got right, or
no,
not
he
so
doesn't
much?
Really. I mean, glancingly, he talks about there was actually a lot of campaign stuff in this book. He talks about Truman versus Dewey and kind of how Truman won. But his thesis says you can learn more by focusing on the campaigns that lose. So fundamentally, it's a book about losing campaigns as a way to understand winning campaigns.
Now, Nick, you point out in your review, I was really struck by this. It seemed a telling point. You say he kind of makes it sound easy. If it was so easy, all the campaigns would work a lot better than so many of them really do. You have these quite gifted politicians. And, you know, we make fun of them all the time. I don't mean just journalists. Mm-hmm. I mean Americans do. They become figures of fun. We take someone like Romney, say, or some of his competitors during the Republican primaries, and we mock and ridicule them all. And we kind of forget, like, most of them had won big elections, you know, big governors of big states, you know, that they come in with high poll ratings sometimes. I mean, it's not as if these are total incompetents. And they're professional politicians. So is there anything they don't really know that Popkin has to tell them? Or is this really about something else, which is luck and circumstance and making the right call and that kind of thing?
Studying campaigns as a political scientist has to be among the more frustrating tasks in social science. You have no natural experiments. It's hard to know why campaigns actually win and lose. Is it really about the campaign organization? And I don't believe, you know, Popkin is trying to present the last word in why campaigns succeed or fail. But I did find myself wondering, you know, I can think of campaigns that did have tons of infighting that still won. You know, Bill Clinton's his reelection campaign in 1996, you had the Republican Svengali Dick Morris and then the liberal Harold Ickes. They were fighting each other fundamentally about the ideas of the campaign. He still won.
And won, you know, given the circumstances, pretty impressively.
That's right. I mean, it is hard to imagine. It's hard to be on the outside and think, well, isn't it obvious that you should arrange your campaign in a way that makes you flexible and able to respond and adapt and shift? And I guess it's sort of a lesson of kind of human relations and the hothouse environment of a campaign that you can't always do that, that you turn to the people you like and trust, that it is fundamentally a human business and not a business.
Thanks so much, Nick.
Thanks, Sam.
That's Nicholas Confessori, political reporter for The New York Times, who this week reviews The Candidate, What It Takes to Win and Hold the White House by Samuel L. Popkin. Well, in this age of girly men and metrosexuals, the question almost half the population is asking is, how can I be a real man? There are two new books on the subject. One's called Man-Made, A Stupid Quest for Masculinity. It's by Joel Stein. And there's How to Land an A330 Airbus and Other Vital Skills for the Modern Man. They're reviewed for us by one of the country's great humorists and columnists. Henry Alford is here to talk about it. Hi, Henry.
Hello, hello.
Okay, so you've been manning up.
I am dripping with testosterone. You're going to be pregnant by the end of this interview, Sam.
All right, so tell us what these guys have to say. Let's start with macho man Joel Stein, who actually says, I believe that he's been raising a son who looks destined to be a loser on Antiques Roadshow rather than to be like a strongman competitor.
Exactly. And Joel Stein should know, because as he tells us in his book, this is a dude who had an easy bake oven as a kid. He once designed a recipe for wine coolers. So we're coming from a very girly place. And essentially he had a kid and felt like he didn't have the sufficient man lore and masculinity to pass on to his kid. So Joel Stein decided to man up. And so he does all these participatory manly acts.
You say kind of Plimpton-like, right?
It's very Plimpton-like. Yeah, there are probably like 10 things that he does, and they run from, you know, going camping with Boy Scouts for a couple of nights to throwing a football with Warren Sapp. He builds up to a cage match, sort of, with Randy Couture, who's the WWF guy.
He does a cage match?
He doesn't quite do a cage match. They have like a shortish fight, at the end of which Joel Stein says he looks like he's been beaten by two male lions who lined their cave with Brillo pads.
So a fun book?
It's totally fun. It's laugh out loud funny.
He's a columnist for Time Magazine.
Yeah,
right?
He's in there practically every week. They even let him write a whole column about his own book. He went very meta for the book. And I think he's a truly, truly hilarious dude. I would put him in the Judd Apatow school of humor, which is to say you're going to get some phallus jokes, but it's heartfelt and ultimately pretty lovely.
Okay, now we've got the second book, How to Land an A330 Airbus. I don't even know if I'm saying that right.
Yeah. And I'm embarrassed to say I had never watched that show. This is the co-host of Top Gear, which is on the BBC, which is a show mostly about vehicles. Usually it's cars, but they crash them, they test drive them, they do all sorts of stuff to them.
That's a television show?
That's a TV show.
In England?
Oh, I mean, come on, there's a show now called My Favorite Pillow on cable. So definitely there's a show called Top Gear. This guy, if Stein's book is immersive and is essentially a work of participatory journalism, James May's book is more theoretical, and he's proposed sort of 9 hypothetical scenarios, and he's going to tell you how to land an airplane, how to eat your best friend, how to escape from a holiday resort. They're kind of kooky, but they're fact-based and they're really fun. He has a very jaunty prose style. I think this book is more like a toilet book. and I say that lovingly.
Yes.
In that it is, you know, the chapters are probably 4,000 words long, lots of pictures, lots of cool diagrams and stuff. So it's something to flip through rather than Joel Stein's book you're going to sit down and actually read.
So both these guys really approach it in a genial and kind of a amused way.
Yeah, absolutely. And they're both menschy, likable dudes. You know, you're not going to get any swaggering or attitude from either of them. And that's sort of where the comedy is that they are these kind of pasty-skinned gentlemen who probably spent a lot of time indoors.
Unlike us.
unlike you and me. Right. And, yeah, and they've set themselves up with these incredible challenges, and it's really fun to see them go at it.
Thanks so much, Henry.
Thanks for having me.
That's Henry Alford, who reviews Man Made and How to Land an A330 Airbus in this week's special how-to issue of the Book Review. And now for the man who gave us this week's how-to issue, but is on the case with forthcoming bestsellers, Greg Coles. Hey, Greg.
Hi, Sam.
What's going to be new on the list this week?
Well, there are a lot of familiar names on the fiction side of things. There are 5 new books, and they're all from repeat offenders, as it were. Starting at number 1, Daniel Silva has his new book, The Fallen Angel, debuts at number 1. Then down at number 5, James Lee Burke has a new Dave Robichaux mystery called Creole Belle. At number 7, Chris Bojalian is back on the list with a book called The Sandcastle Girls. At number 10, the mother and son team of Iris Johansson and Roy Johansson, they each write books separately, but they've also taken to writing books together.
And no relation to Scarlett Johansson.
Not that I know of. They're on the list with a book called Close Your Eyes, a mystery again. And then down at number 14, Orson Scott Card, who wrote the Ender's Game series, is on the list with a book called Earth Unaware. That's co-written with a guy named Aaron Johnston, and it is kind of a backstory to the whole Ender's Game. It's the start of a new series called The First Formic War.
Right. You've talked about Card before in the program.
I have. Aaron Johnston was a new name to me. He's a young guy. And a former comic book writer who really is a big fan of Orson Scott Card's, and he turned some early Card stories into a play while he was in college, a play that got produced, and then he started doing comic book series of some of Card's earlier work. And I guess it made an impression on Card, who approached him, and now they're doing this series together.
And what about nonfiction?
Well, there are 4 new books on the nonfiction side. And the way these things go, 3 of them are either by former entrepreneurs or politically related, and all 3 of those have the dagger that means bulk sales.
And explain again what bulk sales means.
Bulk sales is just instead of an individual buyer going into a store and buying an individual book, it's somebody buying 100 books or 200 books to pass out to supporters or to stockpile in a warehouse or just to try.
Or maybe sometimes give away at lectures at appearances,
yeah,
as well.
That's actually a pretty common explanation. Or, you know, somebody's coming to do a signing and the publisher buys the books and they hand out free copies to the people who are there.
And in some way, those copies may have been paid for. It may be that you bought a ticket to the event.
That's right.
And the ticket price includes the book. But the reason the dagger is affixed to the name and title is so that our readers understand it's not as if individually a huge number of people went in and ordered this particular book. They may have done so, but other significant sales have been recorded in this way.
That's right. That's right. So the 3 books that all have daggers affixed, at number 7, it's a book called The Mobile Wave by a guy named Michael Saylor. Saylor is pretty famous in the business world. He started a company, MicroStrategy, when he was 24 years old, right out of MIT. It's a software company that specializes in business intelligence, database mining, that kind of thing. he's really embraced the changeover to mobile computing. When the iPad came out, he bought iPads for 2,400 people, everyone in his company.
Bulk purchase.
There you go. He thinks mobile computing is really not just going to change our technological future, but change our social future too.
So he means not sitting behind your desktop or even your laptop, but being on the go and doing your computer.
Yeah, mobile computing is smartphones and tablet computers like the iPad. And he thinks it heralds the start of a cashless society, you know, that we'll just scan everything with our phone and pay for it that way. Online education, you know, taking classes over the internet, to get your Harvard degree without ever stepping foot in Cambridge, that kind of thing.
So cashless society is not a euphemism for Great Depression.
Not for Michael Saylor. Although he did once, he lost $6 billion in a day back in 2000. The SEC filed charges against MicroStrategy, accusing them of fraudulently reporting some of their earnings. And the stock lost 90% that day, and his personal fortune went down $6 billion.
He lost $6 billion in a day?
Yeah,
that's more than I make in a week.
The company's still doing very well.
And what else?
At number eight, another former banker named Gerald Chertavian, who is now a social entrepreneur. He started a program called A Year Up, which is also the name of his book, A Year Up. Chertavian was a big brother in the Big Brothers Big Sisters program, and it affected him pretty powerfully. And he started thinking about, as a banker, how can I get these underprivileged kids into the business world? He really looked at the skills gap in America, the education gap and the skills gap, and said, how can I bring these kids along? And he quit his job. He had started a company himself, Conduit, that plays a big role on Wall Street. He had plenty of personal money. So he formed this foundation instead, this program to go into the cities and train young urban adults for jobs. And they've got this great success rate. And this is a book that follows 1 year of them. It looks at a year of A Year Up and the problems that these kids had, some of their challenges, their success stories.
How young are these recruits? So you're not talking about taking high school kids and
No. It's, you know, early 20s. I mean, basically kids who would be in college or just out of college, and giving them the skills that they need.
Good for him.
At number nine, the political book on the list this week, by a guy named Paul Kengor. It's a book called The Communist. It's pretty much a straightforward historical biography of a guy named Frank Marshall Davis, who was a communist activist in Hawaii. He's still alive. He's an older man now. The reason this is, I call it a political book, Kengor doesn't just profile Davis in it, but argues that he was a formative influence on Barack Obama, who met him several times as a teenager. Growing up in Hawaii, there really weren't a lot of black people. Obama's grandfather, Stanley Dunham, knew Frank Marshall Davis and thought that he might be, you know, a good person for young Barry Obama to get to know. And he introduced him and you know, they hung out several times.
And that's what set us on the road to serfdom.
That is the subtext.
But it's not. But he doesn't say book. That. He doesn't make any claims or arguments about Barack Obama himself.
He argues that Davis was a formative influence. That is, that Davis helped set Obama on the path to his political philosophy. So yes, he's making the case that Obama is a closet communist as well, because he once associated with a non-closet communist.
Well, you know, Greg, I wonder about my own past associations, because I once spent years writing a book about a guy who'd been a longtime communist.
Does the New York Times know that, Sam?
Whoops. Let's move on.
There is one more book on the list without a dagger. So Victor Cruz, the New York Giants wide receiver, has written a memoir with Fox sports reporter Peter Schrager called Out of the Blue. Victor Cruz, you may remember, he's the wide receiver who when he...
No, he was fantastic. Yeah. He was like, it was the most exciting player they had.
It was completely a breakout season for him. The Giants, of course, were underdogs when they won the Super Bowl last year. On an underdog team, Victor Cruz was an underdog player. He was not drafted. He only made the team as a walk-on during training camp. He played at a small Division I school at UMass. You know, didn't have a distinguished career, but here was his first season, and he...
Now, this wasn't his very first season on the team, though, was it?
It was his first season as a starter. That's right. And so you know, he had not distinguished himself to this point, and suddenly he just busted out. He is famous, among other things, for every time he scores a touchdown, he dances the salsa in the end zone. He's half Puerto Rican. He was raised... by his Puerto Rican grandparents, and he used to dance salsa in the kitchen with his grandmother to Tito Puente records. The Giants' former quarterbacks coach, Mike Sullivan, told him early on in the season, said to him, you know, it's Hispanic Heritage Month. You got to do something to reflect your heritage in the end zone. And he thought, well, I can't cook rice and beans. I'll dance the salsa.
And he's pretty good at it,
It's become a signature move for him. It's even on the Madden football video game now.
Thanks a lot, Greg.
Thanks, Sam.
Thanks for listening. And remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. You can tell us what you think of this show or any New York Times podcast by emailing podcasts@nytimes.com. I'm Sam Tannenhaus.